Reconvene the Monday, March 5th, 2012 meeting of the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. We have been in recess, and we are going to proceed with the agenda that we talked about this morning. We are going to alter this a little bit. We're going to hear Senator Hoffman's bill, Senate File 1876, and then out of consideration to a member who's not, or a bill from a member who's not a part of this committee, Senator Gerlach, who's on our agenda as the last bill, we're going to move him into the second spot since he has another committee he needs to go to. So at this point, Senator Hoffman, if you are ready, we'll take up Senate File 1876. Whenever you're ready, Senator.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, this bill, Senate File 1876, is a technical bill for the agency. It's a bill about emergency medical personnel licensure. And then there's, it should be a non-controversial bill. I know, famous last words on this committee. But I'm going to turn over outlining the bill to you to
Thank you, Senator. Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Pam Bilodeau. I'm the Executive Director for the Emergency Medical.
Could I just ask you to bring the microphone close, and then could you please restate your name for the record so we get that clearly on tape?
Mr. Chair, my name is Pam Bilodeau, and I'm the Executive Director for the Emergency Medical Services Regulatory Board. And the bill is an upkeeping. It's an update bill for housekeeping for 144E, and there are five areas that are being updated. The first is for the new national education standards. Minnesota's adopted the National Highway Transportation and Safety Administration standards, which become effective in 2012, and most educational programs are already teaching at or above the level of the new standards. The second part of the housekeeping bill is for radio communications plans. It points to the language so that it aligns with the State of Minnesota Department of Public Safety, Division of Emergency Communications Network. It's their radio communication standards, and it just aligns the two plans, and they set the standards. The third one is for disciplinary actions, and it's just strengthening, adding theft, adding assault, violating controlled substance laws that have the potential for causing harm to the public. So some pretty minor updates. And the fourth one is for procedures and equipment, updating procedures and equipment such as adding commercially manufactured tourniquets and moving language from the rules to statutes. And the last one is aligning the definitions with updates. And with that, I stand for questions.
All right. Are there questions from members of the committee?
Mr. Chair,
Sir,
at some point, I do have an amendment for the bill, whenever you want to deal with that.
To this bill?
To Senator Hoffman's bill, yes.
All right. Are there questions? Are there any other testifiers?
None that I know of, Mr. Chair.
Do you know if there's any opposition to this bill, Ms. Bilodeau?
No, we've spoken with several of the associations, and none that we're aware of. It sounds like no one has any issues.
So it's the perfect bill, I guess, except for the amendment that Senator Fischbach has. So I guess at this time, if you are ready, we'll take up the amendment.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to offer the A1 amendment. I am not sure if it's in the packets.
I think we're getting it handed out to us right now. So is this your amendment or is this an author's amendment?
Mr. Chair, this is my amendment. And actually, it is essentially the bill that was on. It's essentially Senate File 1883, and the suggestion was made to put it on this since this is kind of a department bill, and this is a little bit of a technical amendment. It and if people have it, I can give it. Explanation. The first section is basically clarifying language. It maintains the same deadlines. It's stated a little differently, but it clarifies that the notice to the chief administration officer needs to be notarized, And then the second part on page 2, the bottom half of page 2, this allows additional time for some folks to put in their notice, to put in their affidavit, because of a mix-up that happened with some mailing and for some of the volunteer firefighter, or excuse me, volunteer EMS. And so, and then the last part of it does discuss a little bit about how the payment would be handled internally.
Okay. Okay. Senator Fischbach, I don't want to presume, but I am going to presume that you've had some discussion with the author of the bill. And
yes, and, I did talk to Senator Hoffman.
And Senator Hoffman, this is an acceptable amendment to your bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I will accept this as a friendly amendment.
Any questions from members? Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair and Senator Fischbach, I'm looking at line 2.23 and 2.29 and 2.31, where the rest of the bill talks about August 1st, presumably of every year, but these three instances seem to be this year and last year. So I'm wondering if this credit reporting section is just a one-time thing for this year, or how does this work?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, yes, it is. There was it corrects the mix-up, the mailing issue, the things didn't get in time and it was lost. So this is a one-time correction for that.
And my other question, Mr. Chair?
Senator Higgins.
I know who Sam's is, but who was Cooper?
Roger Cooper?
Roger Cooper, Mr. Chair.
Sorry.
Oh, Mr. Chair, my understanding is Roger Cooper was from the lower body. So that's why.
And here I thought it was James Fenimore Cooper.
Oh, my gosh.
But Senator Higgins, there's no shame in not knowing that.
You remember Roger Cooper?
I don't.
Oh, my God, I'm old then.
The other body. All right. On the A1 amendment, Senator Fischbach moves that the A1 amendment be adopted to Senate File 1876. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment is adopted. And
thank
now
you.
Back to the bill. Senator Hoffman, any other comments you wish to make?
I don't really have any, Mr. Chair, unless Ms. Bilodeau does.
Ms. Bilodeau?
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Does this need to be referred to another committee?
I haven't heard of anyone that's asked for it, Mr. Chair.
I don't believe we've gotten any requests for hearing. Is it your desire that this be just passed to the floor then?
That would be my desire, Mr. Chair.
And I have not seen a fiscal note, so I'm assuming this is clean and good to go. All right.
There was no fiscal note, Mr. Chair.
No fiscal note. Would you like to move the bill?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I'd like to move that Senate File 1876 be recommended to pass and move to the floor of the Senate.
All right. Senator Hoffman moves Senate File 1876 be recommended to pass. Refer to the floor. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries. Thank you, Ms. Bilodeau. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. So that was good. Two bills with one hearing. If we do that, we'll be done in about half an hour. Rosen, are you ready? Senate File 1543. Or did we want to take Senator? Mm-hmm. Can I interrupt you 1 second? Can I ask Senator Gerlach? Senator Gerlach, are you out in the audience there? Are you good for, or do you need to go right now? Or?
No, I'm okay.
Okay. I apologize. I said I was going to take you a second, and I just got so excited. We did two bills at once that I just went right to the next one. So, all right. Senator Rosen, sorry. Go ahead.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Senate File 1543 should be a fairly quick bill because we are saving there's savings in this fiscal note. So we're going to like that. This is the community paramedic bill. And if you remember, members and Mr. Chair, last year we basically passed that we put the statute of a community paramedic as a definition in the statute and establishes it as a new provider type. And it also, now the legislature, directed the Department of Human Services in consultation with various provider groups to determine, quote, the specified community paramedic services and payment rates for these services covered by MA. The services to be covered include the health assessment, the chronic disease monitoring and education, medication compliance, immunization and vaccination, lab specimen collection, hospital discharge follow-up care, minor medical procedures approved by the ambulance medical director. And if you remember, members, this really was an exciting piece of legislation. It has been received very well out there. And like I said, this is something that is part of the continuum of care. I must say that the services that I just listed must not result in duplication of services. So it's an ongoing continuum of care, like I said. I must first, too, Mr. Chair, just thank the department for really stepping up to the plate and making this work. We've met several times over the interim, and there was a working group that was put together to develop this and get the language and get this this bill in place. So if I could just say a special thanks to, I'm going to miss somebody's name for sure, Dave and Meredith and Julie and Steve, if you don't mind. So if there is a fiscal note that is involved, and if, as you can see, Mr. Chair, we do have a savings, and I'm very excited about that.
That is good to see.
It's very good. Yeah. And what was interesting in these discussions in the working groups, and I wasn't able to go to all of them, but we did have several, that you start looking at how this can be, how this can go forward, whether it's diabetic. There's several. If you go to some nursing homes in Greater Minnesota and you look at how many people are in these nursing homes for diabetes, and they should really not be in there. They just need some, you know, proper care. 10% of the people that are diabetic get proper care. You can really look forward to this being in proper direction, and they do have proper direction with this being a continuum of care and part of the care plan. So with that, I have OJ Doyle and Buck Alpin with me, and they would like to explain specifically.
Well, and Senator Rosen, I understand there is a delete everything amendment. Should we adopt that before we get into discussion of the bill?
Yes. I would like to move the A2 amendment, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Rosen moves the A2 amendment as an author's amendment to Senate File 1543, and we're distributing that right now. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay.
And Mr. Chair, this amendment basically is the language that was agreed upon by the working group in the department.
Right.
And it talks specifically of how many times they can have this service and the MA reimbursement.
Is the fiscal note tied to the amendment?
Yes.
It is. Okay. So we're good to go.
Yeah.
So
great.
Who would like to go first?
Go quick, Mr. Chair. Buck McAlpin on behalf of the Ambulance Association. Senator Rosen's right. Lots of folks work to pull this together. Members have asked where we're at with the program. There's about 15 community paramedics trained from a class the last year and a half. There's 12 more in a program now at Hennepin Tech. One college is teaching the curriculum. And we were just awarded North Memorial, Alina, Health East Transportation, and the Hennepin Tech College a $250,000 grant from DEED, Job Labor Workforce Group, to train 100 of them over the next 3 years in a class that will start again in April. Not just in the urban areas, but in rural Minnesota. There's projects going on in small communities. Park Rapids, we have a pilot project. We're looking at some spots out in Marshall, Minnesota, Northwest Minnesota. So the neat thing about this program is it fits all different types of systems, and we're excited to look at a different way to offer services as we move forward in EMS.
All right. Thank you. Nothing to add?
Right. I want my bill to pass.
So you're not going to talk.
Are there any questions from members of the committee? Any questions? All right. Senator Rosen, I imagine we'll have to take this through Finance Committee because there is a fiscal note, even though it shows a savings. So that's my belief that we need to do that. But I do want to commend you and others for working on this. I know that you've been working on this since last year. I think this is a good idea and good legislation, and I appreciate your working it out. So thanks for that.
Mr. Chair, and I do want to thank you for your assistance on this and the department and all the other people that came and worked on this amendment. They did a stellar job. That's how we got to this point. So with that, Mr. Chair, I move that Senate File 1543 be recommended, passed, and sent to the Finance. provision, as amended.
As amended. Senate File 1543, recommended pass, sent to Finance Committee. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion carries.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members.
Now, Senator Gerlach, if you're ready. Sir Gerlach, you want to
yes.
Take
Thank
up
you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Today I bring a bill that was actually heard last year. It's the Nurse Licensure Compact. We heard it last year. It was a little bit haphazard. It was enrolled in the or combined in the Omnibus Health and Human Services Finance Bill last year as a policy item. And, of course, we know that original bill was vetoed. And this was not included in the special session bill. So we bring this before you again this year with our intent to pass this as a standalone bill. I've been working on this issue for, I think it's 6 years now, Judy told me. And every year that goes by, we have a greater need for this. 24 other states have adopted the Nurse Licensure Compact, including all of the states that border Minnesota. You have a handout, or you're getting a handout with a map on there, and you can see that. So what is the Nurse Licensure Compact? It will allow a registered nurse, a licensed practical nurse, or vocational nurse to have one multi-state license in a primary state of residence, the home state, and to practice in other compact states, referred to as the remote states, both physically and electronically. And its key is while subject to each state's practice laws and discipline. That doesn't change. I won't go all through all the bullets on this handout that you have, but I do want to bring your attention to the, you can read a lot of that, but the bottom ones, which I think are key. Oftentimes there's opposition saying that, well, we won't have the same high standards for our nurse, our licensed nurses in Minnesota, and that's just simply not true. There's three bullets there, and I'll just draw your attention to those at the bottom of that page, that nurses in all 50 states must still pass the NCLEX exam and graduate from an accredited school of nursing, which is national accreditation, to obtain nurse licensure. That's one. Also under the compact, states maintain their right and authority to regulate nursing practices within their borders. Each state enforces its own Nurse Practice Act and maintains a board of nursing. And thirdly, every nurse practicing in an NLC member state must comply with the practice laws of the state in which the patient is located at the time the care is rendered. The reason I bring those up this time is because we spent a lot of time and a lot of discussion on those items in the last committee hearing last year. And I want to hit home that these items are addressed, and I want members to feel comfortable. We have some folks here that are going to be speaking very shortly in a lot of the technical details of the bill and how it will work and be able to do that. But I also just wanted you to understand that there are a lot of supporters for this legislation. You'll have a list that will say the NLC supporters. It's a very long list. You will hear from some opponents today. But the numbers won't come close to the list you're seeing here of healthcare organizations and nursing organizations that believe this will enhance patient care, this will enhance their profession, and that this is good for Minnesota and the right thing to do at this time. One of the letters you have here, and you won't have testimony directly from this organization, but the Minnesota LPN Alliance, Licensed Practical Nurses. The Minnesota LPN Alliance, I'm just going to point out just two small points on this letter that are very important. The Minnesota LPN Alliance is comprised of over 2,000 LPNs throughout the state of Minnesota and are represented by unions such as SEIU, Healthcare Minnesota, the AFSCME Council 65, the United Food and Commercial Workers, and the Minnesota Licensed Practical Nurse Association Council 105, and they say that we believe that the Board of Nursing has researched the compact with due diligence and is presenting this bill with intent that this will help protect the public health and safety of Minnesotans. Also, there is a letter from the Minnesota Association of Colleges of Nursing, which is a group representing all 21 baccalaureate and higher degree nursing programs in the state of Minnesota. And they say that their organization membership remains supportive of the Minnesota Nurses Association, the MNA, and its mission to represent the state's nurses at the bargaining table. It says, we respectfully disagree with the concern raised by the MNA and other collective bargaining organizations that this legislation would interfere with collective bargaining and the ability of nurses to strike. Based on our experience, nurses from other states are brought in regardless of the lack of compact legislation. We believe that the benefits of the Nurse Licensure Compact greatly outweigh any potential effect upon M&A activities. And then, of course, we will be having some testimony from some of the other people that have included some letters. The momentum for this bill has been growing the more the years have gone by. One question brought up frequently is, what is this? Why do we want to enter into a compact? Have we done this with other issues? I have a list here of 26, and this was made up a year ago, so I don't know if that we've added any, but this is 26 different compacts that Minnesota has entered into over the course of decades that have proven to be in the best interest of Minnesotans. 26. This is not a new concept about working in partnerships with other states to provide the best patient care, or in this case, any with all of these areas, whatever the item may be, to bring be beneficial to our citizens. Members, we have some individuals that are going to explain in detail about the exact bill before you. And first, I'm going to introduce Shirley Brecken. Shirley Brecken is the executive director of the Minnesota Board of Nursing. And she has a few things to say.
Before we do that, Senator Gerlach, I just wanted to ask maybe a technical question on page 10, line 10, 10.10. There is a date, July 1, 2011. Yes. I'm assuming that you would like to change that date.
Yes.
And also there is on page 11 the effective date. And I just would like to get your advice about whether we need to have a small oral amendment to change some dates.
Yes, so, Mr. Chairman, you're right. This was last year's bill, assuming a passage last year. So if you're right, I guess somebody on the committee would need to move. And I could suggest that on line 10.10 that year 2011 be changed to 2012,
okay.
Simply adding that year. And then also on page 11, changing that to July 1st of 2013.
Okay. Maybe I could ask Senator Newman moves an oral amendment to change on line 10.10, strike 2011 and replace with 2012, and also on line 11.3, strike 2012 and replace it with 2013. Any questions from members? All in favor of the amendment, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? All right. Okay, Senator Gerlach, it's back in shape, and Ms. Brecken, are you the next guest speaker?
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Shirley Brecken, and I'm the executive director for the Board of Nursing. Senator Gerlach asked that I just hit some of the high points of what the purpose of the bill is. He already did a great job with giving you an overview, but essentially what the bill does is authorize the compact or adopt the compact in Minnesota. This compact has been adopted by 24 other states, and Minnesota would join those 24 states that agree that if a nurse is licensed in the home state of one of those 24 states, plus Minnesota, the individual may practice nursing in all of the party states based on their home state license. So that means that, for example, as it stands now, a nurse that's licensed in Wisconsin, which is a member of the compact, currently has the authority to practice in all 23 other states that are in the compact, and if Minnesota were to join the compact, that would be the same. The individual meets the licensure requirements in the state, in their home state, but must practice within the Nurse Practice Act and all other laws that apply in the party state in which they practice. So I know one of the allegations of the nurses' union is that it drives it to a lower standard, and that's simply not the case, because the nurse must practice according to the standards and the law in the state where the patient is located and the nurse is practicing. That the compact does not change that. That's the way it is now. What the compact does is it provides for licensure, determining where the licensure occurs, that is in the state of residence, and it provides for the jurisdiction of the boards. First of all, the home state board is the only board that can take action against the licensed. However, all of the other party states may take action against the privilege to practice if the nurse violates the law. The bill also provides for a national database, and that is currently in place. It's called NurseSIS. It is operated by the National Council of State Boards of Nursing, which is comprised of all of the boards of nursing in the United States and its territories. Information regarding licensure and disciplinary action is submitted to that database. And then the bill goes on further to provide for the interchange of information from that database and among the party states. Finally, the last part of the bill really addresses the application of the compact and the law to other laws in the state, such as it requires, of course, up front that the nurse, anyone practicing in Minnesota under the compact, has to abide by the laws of the Practice Act, the Nurse Practice Act of Minnesota. It also provides that this law cannot supersede labor laws. It also provides for that anyone who is alleged to have violated the law in Minnesota has the privilege of the due process, just like any nurse licensed in the state of Minnesota. It also addresses the reporting requirements, that those reporting requirements in Minnesota, we have mandatory reporting requirements for institutions and insurers and the courts, and it provides that those same reporting requirements are in place for any nurse practicing in Minnesota under the privilege. And also it provides that the board can take the same kind of disciplinary action against the privilege to practice as it has the authority to do to take against the license in Minnesota. I'd like to just address a couple of the concerns that have been raised by the nurses' union and really address some of those inaccuracies. Right now, we have a Nurse Practice Act, a licensure model system that is over 100 years old, and we all know that we are practicing healthcare, practicing nursing far differently than we did over 100 years ago. So adopting the compact is really the kind of government reform that's needed for licensing nurses today and in the future, and regulating nursing practice for the future. One of the things that the nurses allege is that there would be a race to the bottom, because nurses with the same licensure standards or requirements would be allowed to work side by side by nurses who are licensed in Minnesota. But nurses in Minnesota, any nurse who practices in Minnesota, whether it's under a Minnesota nurse license or the privilege to practice granted by the compact, must practice within the law and nursing standards of the state of Minnesota. The compact would not change that. All states require, as Senator Gerlach said, nurses, individuals to graduate from an approved school of nursing, and that they take the same licensure exam. Again, that doesn't change under the compact. The nurses' union says that nurses from another state would not meet the same educational requirements. Quite frankly, it's unbelievable that a school of nursing in any state would educate nurses or individuals to not pass the licensure exam. As much as I would like to tell you that Minnesota graduates do better on the licensure exam than other states, that's not true. I would offer that many other states actually require nursing education programs to have a higher pass rate than Minnesota does. And unfortunately, the pass rate for graduates of Minnesota's associate degree nursing programs actually is below the national average pass rate. We have shared this information with MNSCU, and I know that they are addressing it. Additionally, nurses who are licensed in another state and come to Minnesota to practice, move to Minnesota right now, are licensed by a process that we call endorsement. In other words, the Board of Nursing in Minnesota acknowledges that that other state licensed that individual and grants them that a Minnesota license based on that granting of that license. As a level of competence is concerned, years ago, states did their own exams and had their own pass rates, their own pass standard. Today, we all use the same exam, and it's the same passing standard. And this was intended to standardize the measurement of competence across the country. And so the fact that nurses, any nurse who practices in the United States must pass that same national licensure examination assures that standardization of competence. Again, the nurses' union alleges that the states would have inconsistent standards for safe practice. Again, that's not true. State boards of nursing look to national standards, such as those of the American Nurses Association and the National Federation of Practical Nurses. They also state that other states have lesser standards for licensure with criminal records and that some don't do criminal background checks. Currently, Minnesota doesn't do criminal background checks. In fact, the board has a bill, Senate File 1053, which would authorize the board to do criminal background checks, and the nurses' union actually opposes that bill. The nurses' union alleges some states are prevented from disclosing allegations to the compact states, and others delay reporting of barred nurses. If a nurse is under investigation in a compact state, they say it may take months for Minnesota to learn about the results of the investigation. The compact actually, again, this isn't true. The compact actually provides for an exchange of significant investigative data. That means if a nurse is using a multi-state license, has a complaint filed in one state, all the states in the compact have access to the investigation information if there is a significant risk of harm to the public. We now have to wait for a state to take action. Under the compact, we will actually know much sooner and can provide greater public protection. I would like to just describe a little bit the federal model that we currently have in the United States, and that is that, for instance, at the Veterans Administration Hospital in Minneapolis, a nurse who's practicing there can have a license in any state. That individual, even that, though that facility is located in Minneapolis, that individual does not have to have a Minnesota license. A Texas license, a New York license, any nurse license will give them the authority to practice in that federal facility. And that's true of military service also. Last year, Congress actually expanded this and enacted a bill extending to the fact that in any location, so it didn't even have to be a federal facility or a military facility, but an individual licensed in any state could work in any location as long as the practice was within the scope of their federal duties. Additionally, in January of this year, the American Telehealth Association sponsored a briefing for members of Congress for medical licenses regarding the licensing and regulation of physicians and all other healthcare providers. They pointed out that the issues go beyond telemedicine to include travelers, large employers, and others. Senator Udall has drafted a bill to allow practice across state lines. Additionally, one of the things that the White House has recognized or that Congress has recognized is that there are over 100,000 military spouses with professional licenses who have trouble transferring their license as they move from state to state. Military spouse employment is verging on 26%, more than double the national average. First Lady Michelle Obama and Dr. Jill Biden are tackling this issue by urging states to relax licensure requirements for military families as they move from base to base, and there is a bill pending to do that. So there is this movement to reduce barriers for individuals as they move from state to state or as they practice across state lines. In conclusion, I'd like to say that this compact has been in effect over 10 years now in the United States. Of these 24 states, there has been no lowering of the standard of practice of nursing. There has been no increase of nurse licensure fees as a result of the states that are in the compact. Employers now have greater access to information regarding a nurse's authority to practice, and boards of nursing that have enacted the compact are able to act more quickly and more efficiently through shared investigations and similarly taking action. Patients who file a complaint can expect better enforcement because of that. An enactment of this bill really reforms nursing regulation for how nursing care is delivered today and in the future. Rather than decrease public protection, the compact empowers the board to do a better job of public protection. And I thank you for your attention, and I would be available for questions.
Thank you. Ms. Brecken, I did want to ask you briefly about the fiscal note, which I believe was the same note that we had last year.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
And I'm trying to remember. I know that you probably explained this, but could you comment on it? My recollection was that the costs were going to be absorbed by the board's budget. Is that correct?
Mr. Chair, thank you for the question. Yes, the fiscal note is approximately $200,000 for each year. I'm mixing that up with the criminal background check bill. Excuse me for that. Any of the costs associated with the communication that we would have to have with nurses and the changes we have to make to the database, as well as the adjustments we have to make, would all be able to be handled through the board's reserve fund. We currently have sufficient funds that there would be no need to increase fees to cover the costs.
All right. Thank you. Any questions? If not, we can proceed with
Mr. Chairman, I have three other testifiers. I just want to offer up some brief comments of support for the bill.
All right.
Excuse me. My name is Judith Santiago Judy. I am a registered nurse in Minnesota. My area of practice for the past 14 years.
Could I interrupt you for 1 second? I think we missed Senator Sharon wanted to ask a question of the previous witness.
Thank
is that
you.
Correct?
Yeah. No, Senator Gerlach.
Yeah. I'm sorry.
I'm sorry. Was late to the hand up in.
No, that's okay.
I know we're moving along. I know that this is heard last year. And so I was just curious if there's anything different in this bill from last year's bill.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sharon, there is nothing different in this bill from last year other than additional authors that we've added since last year.
And then a follow-up question. I think this bill passed out of this committee last year, majority vote, and probably will again tonight. So my question is there anything in the bill or anything that's changed that would change the governor's veto of this bill? I mean, that's really where it ended last year. If the bill's the same, what in the governor's veto were at issue that has been resolved somehow in this language or in your work with the governor?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Sharon,
what I can tell you is
two things. There are a long and growing list of different groups that are supportive of this that have all been, in the past year, been reaching out to the governor's office and making their case. And in addition, we have added additional co-authors to the bill from his own party. We've added DFL authors. Senator Langseth is now a co-author on this bill. You know that Senator Norton is the Representative Norton from Rochester is the chief author in the other body, and we've added some additional authors. We also Representative Huntley from the other body is very supportive of this. And with those additional co-authors and the long list of and growing list of support, and the every year the need becomes greater, then the momentum builds, and it is my hope to make a strong enough case this year to convince the governor that this is something that's time has come.
Okay, thank you, Ms. Santiago.
I'll just be brief. I have been a nurse case manager telephonically for the past 14 years and have worked with Senator Gerlach for about 6 years, as I feel that this is a bill that is important to me and to my practice. As a workers' compensation case manager, most of my practice was done telephonically. How it affected me personally is that I am also licensed by endorsement in Wisconsin, South Dakota, Iowa, and North Dakota. These are our bordering states. As border states, the nurses from all of those states are able to practice in Minnesota currently without having to obtain a Minnesota license. So it's already taking place where nurses could come here without a Minnesota license. They just register with the Board of Nursing within 10 days of practice. That affects me because that isolates me. It costs time and money to obtain licensures in other states. Learning of the Nurse Licensure Compact appeared to be a good and sound solution for this. I am also a part of the Minnesota Organization of Leaders in Nursing. I serve as their government affairs chair. MOLN is a professional nursing organization that recognizes all nurses as leaders. It's a voluntary organization in membership, and as a professional organization, it is committed to promoting educational and mentoring opportunities that focus on standards of excellence in patient safety, patient care, and advancement in nursing profession. The MOLN board has supported the Nurse Licensure Compact for a number of years. In the areas of patient safety, the participating compact states and boards of nursing are able to exchange significant investigatory information for nurses who may be entering the state and pose a potential harm to patients. This ensures our patients that we care for every day the right that they will have a safe nurse in the time of their most vulnerable need. Patient care and access. Continuity of care is enhanced through the Nurse Licensure Compact by decreasing the regulatory barriers that may cause unnecessary delays in initiating or continuing care for our patients due to geographic location. For nurse practice, Minnesota would continue to regulate nursing standards and practice. All nurses that enter Minnesota, whether it is as a resident nurse, a border state nurse, or a compact nurse, are under the same expectation to follow Minnesota Nurse Practice Act at all times. The Nurse Licensure Compact does not interfere with the state's sovereign ability to regulate nursing, which includes educational standards and patient safety. Information in the bill itself can be located in Article 2, Section C, line 3.20 through line 3.24. I've spent many years looking at this issue from all sides to ensure that I was not pursuing something that would cause a potential harm to my patients or to my profession. This is not a national licensure. This is done state by state. It's an agreement, a compact. I've learned that the Nurse Licensure Compact does not decrease or reduce patient safety in any way, and in fact enhances it. Remember, we already have nurses practicing in this state under licensure by endorsement and under the border state recognition law. It does offer patients added security. It does add access to care. It does enhance continuity of practice. And in the 12-year history of the Nurse Licensure Compact, there have been no reported instances of the Nurse Licensure Compact being used as a method to break strikes in any way. The Nurse Licensure Compact is good for patients, it's good for nurses, and it's good for business. Thank you very much, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee.
Thank you, Ms. Santiago. Any questions? We have next on the list Joel McLaughlin, and then following that I have Aaron Sexton. So, Ms. McLaughlin.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, my name is Joel McLaughlin, and I'm the Director of Nursing for Health Partners. Health Partners is an integrated care system with sites located in the Twin Cities, St. Cloud, Duluth, and Western Wisconsin. As health care providers across Minnesota, we often compete for business, but we are all united in our focus to provide best and safe care for all of our patients. At Regents Hospital, we are the only Level 1 and pediatric trauma center hospital in the East Metro, and we provide these same trauma services to patients from adjacent states, especially many patients from Western Wisconsin. Regents is also a regional burn center. Thus, we receive patients from North Dakota, South Dakota, and Iowa for this specialized care. As a standard of care, we contact our patients after discharge from the hospital to ensure an understanding of home care instructions, ensure follow-up appointments have been scheduled, and provide support to patients and families. These calls are made to every patient, regardless of where they live, to ensure continuity of care after discharge and prevent hospital readmissions. Continuing and coordinated care, especially for our chronically ill patients, is also important for nurses to provide in ambulatory care. Patients expect nurses to provide care management services that can be easily accessed and often need to be performed across state lines using telenursing technology. Currently, our nurses need to obtain licensure in multiple states in order to provide nursing follow-up and care outside of Minnesota. This is a compliance burden and is very expensive. Requiring multiple licensures does not support our goal of lowering overall health care costs while providing best care, best experience. The Multi-State Nursing Licensure Compact Bill is an effort to protect the public and minimize unnecessary barriers to obtaining safe and easily accessible nursing care. To sum up my testimony, I would like you to take away the following compelling reasons to support this bill. This bill will increase access to equitable care, improve patient safety, reduce health care costs, and increase patient satisfaction. The last but not least important reason is that surrounding states are already members of the compact. Health Partners strongly advocates Minnesota's adopting the Nurse Licensure Compact to support nurses in providing best care for patients long-term, regardless of where they are located. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Ms. Sexton. And then next I have Heidi Holtz.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Erin Sexton, and I'm here tonight representing Mayo Clinic. Mayo Clinic does support Senate File 230. Mayo Clinic has operations in multiple states, many of which are members of the Nurse Licensure Compact. Adoption of the Nurse Licensure Compact in Minnesota provides our nurses with the opportunity to provide their expertise and skilled services to our patients in our border states, as well as throughout the country more efficiently. We are all working to provide our patients with the best health care when they are in our facilities and when our patients return home. As technology and the new effective models of care move forward, the NLC will provide clarity around newer mediums for providing care, such as telenursing, our nurse helplines. We recognize that we will not be treating patients the same today in the future as we are today, and we need to be prepared to meet the needs of our patients and evolve to accommodate the new models of care. I ask that you please reference the letter submitted by Mayo Clinic, St. Luke's, Essentia, Sanford, and Health Partners. As systems serving many of our border communities, we are united in our belief that we must practice the best treatment and protocols in Minnesota, regardless of where our patients come from. That's why we are all supporting the Nurse Licensure Compact and are here tonight in support of Senate File 230.
Thank you. Any questions? Ms. Holst. I have next on my list Linda Hamilton.
That'll be opposition, Mr. Chairman.
Is that the beginning of the testimony? Okay, so Ms. Holst.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Heidi Holstie. I represent care providers in Minnesota, and today I'm here in support of Senate File 230 on behalf of care providers of Minnesota and Aging Services of Minnesota, and together we come to the Capitol and lobby as the long-term care imperative. The longstanding shortage of nurses in our members' nursing homes, assisted living facilities, and home and community-based services settings is acute and pervasive. The Nurse Licensure Compact has the potential to ease this shortage. Currently, all states contiguous to Minnesota have enacted the Nurse Licensure Compact: North Dakota, South Dakota, Iowa, and Wisconsin. Therefore, healthcare facilities along our border areas and elsewhere in the state would benefit from this legislation. Increasingly, long-term care providers are utilizing telemedicine or other technology that crosses state borders. This legislation would clarify nurse licensure requirements and eliminate the need for multiple licenses. We thank you for sponsoring this legislation and are open to any questions.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Okay. Seeing none. Senator Gerlach.
Mr. Chairman, that concludes my testimony for the proponents of the bill and why this, like as I said, the time has come to pass this.
All right. We do have some people who wish to testify, I presume, in opposition. I have Linda Hamilton, followed by Jean Ross, Shannon Cunningham, Bernadine Engeldorf, and Carrie Mortrude. So I would just invite those people, as one person concludes their testimony, to make their way to the witness table, and Ms. Hamilton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, good evening. My name is Linda Hamilton, and I am a registered nurse. With over 30 years of experience, I currently work at Children's Hospitals and Clinics in Minneapolis in the newborn ICU. I am president of the Minnesota Nurses Association. Minnesota Nurses Association represents 20,000 nurses over the Midwest, including Wisconsin and Iowa. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. First, fundamentally, we disagree with the majority of the points previously expressed. We will lay those out for you. We are here today in opposition to the national nurse licensure for several reasons. My colleagues and I will address the following areas of concern as they relate to loss of nursing jobs, revenue, regulation of patient safety, and state sovereignty. I specifically would like to address a potential loss of jobs for Minnesota nurses and the certain loss of revenue for our state. Regarding nursing jobs, the proponents of national nurse licensure claim this compact will create nursing jobs for Minnesota nurses wanting to practice in other states. On the other hand, this will also decrease nursing jobs for Minnesota nurses because registered nurses from any compact state would be allowed to take those jobs. In reality, it creates an incentive for employers to hire non-Minnesota nurses through the National Nurse Licensure Compact because the requirement for licensure is less stringent in many of these compact states. National licensure will create confusion in workplace planning because we won't know who is practicing in our state. This will make it impossible to guide future projections for healthcare planning and access to care. As we move toward the healthcare homes and accountable care organizations, we need freedom to hire based on our own state's needs as opposed to those determined by compact home states. The Minnesota Board of Nursing will not have the ability to track where each of these compact nurses are working. How are we able to assess the needs for nurses in Minnesota without this information? Finally, our state will lose revenue because national nurses licensure prohibits individual states from assessing fees to compact licensees. Currently, Minnesota charges a fee through licensure by endorsement to cover the administrative costs related to disciplinary and investigatory responsibilities. Under national nurse licensure, this fee is not allowed. With lost revenue, it is inevitable that Minnesota, like other compact states, will be forced to compensate by raising licensure fees for nurses who possess a Minnesota license. Should our nurses be punished? Are nurses born and living and working in Minnesota? Should we be expected to pay more in order to offset the costs of hospitals and medical centers who are tiring from paying multiple licensing fees for nurses that they bring in from out of state? Should nurses in Minnesota be held to higher licensing fees because medical centers don't want to continue to pay for out-of-state nursing licensing fees? Should we really punish our own nurses to benefit the hospitals? Please support Minnesota nurses by voting no to a national nurse licensure. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hamilton. Are there questions? Seeing none, Jean Ross, and then followed by Shannon Cunningham.
Hello, my name is Jean Ross. I'm a registered nurse and have been so for many, many years. I practiced for over 35 years. I also hold the position of a president for National Nurses United, which is the national nurses organization that Minnesota nurses belong to. And I guess I would like to just share a little bit of what I've learned going across the country and talking to nurses who are working with us. A great many of them, since we've been doing a lot of work in the southern states, have come from other states, sometimes California down to Florida or Texas or Nevada, oftentimes from New York or Massachusetts down to a hospital in Florida or Texas. What the nurses say to me is they can't believe the difference in the standards between where they learned to practice and what they've learned in moving. The traveling nurses will tell us the same thing, and their standards vary anything from how many patients they can care for at a time to other kinds of issues within a Nurse Practice Act that would tell that nurse in no circumstances does he or she do this. That is only to be done by a physician. That is only to be done by a registered nurse. That can be done by an LPN, LVN, licensed practical or vocational nurse. So you can imagine the confusion should you be one of these people traveling. Be that as it may, I think that what we're most concerned about is, as others will say after me and as Linda said somewhat herself, the patient's safety. We have some examples, and I know that we gave you some of this paperwork to read at your leisure, and you'll be happy to know I'm not going to read the entire article to you. But I am going to lay out some of the incidences here so we can illustrate a little bit what we're talking about. And I can say the names of these nurses because it is a matter of public record when a nurse has had issues that have engendered endangered patients. So we have a Craig Pesky in 2007 from Wisconsin, fired for stealing Dilaudid. 6 months later is working in North Carolina under a multi-state license. So you can have action in one state taken against you. There is nothing in that compact that makes sure that that follows you into another state where you may be practicing. He will tell you himself afterwards that as he looked at things, he didn't realize, he was surprised to find that his license was still valid after having been fired in Wisconsin. There's a Therese Morgan, or Therese Holmes as she could be known either way, also with a multi-state license in Maryland. Arizona banned her in January of 2009 after 5 incidents, not minor incidences, because we would be the first to say we'll support a nurse who has systems issues as opposed to a practice issue of his or her own. There's a Stephen Woodfin, who is a nurse anesthetist. He surrendered his right to practice in North Carolina in January of 2006 because of substance abuse. Nearly 2 years later, in Texas, he passed out during a procedure, a surgery for a patient. Another Dana Hickman suspended from practice in Texas in September of 2006 after she administered vitamin K too quickly. And the next year, she was placed on probation in California because of the Texas discipline. There's a lag there. Right now, there are about 24 states that are members of the compact. And for all the reasons that Linda mentioned earlier, we still take issue because of the difficulty that we have in checking up on nurses who should be checked up upon. And I will leave you with the last example, which is one you may have read about because it's more recent. It was in the fall, in September, in California, where a nurse actually caused the death of a patient. And that nurse had issues in another state. She was traveling there and hooked up the wrong tube, something that was meant only to go to the stomach, went into intravenously into the vein. So these are some of the issues we deal with, and I know that when we've had talks before with our State Board of Nursing, they have always been quick to point out that their duty is to protect the safety of the public, not necessarily to protect the nurse. And we agree with them, but we see no way in which something like this is here to protect the public. It just doesn't make sense. I thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Ross. Any questions? Shannon Cunningham and then Bernadine Engeldorf.
Actually, I'm Bernadine,
I'm
so
sorry.
I'm going to go next. That's all right. Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Bernadine Engeldorf. I am a registered nurse for approximately 30-plus years. If I say the exact amount, somewhat gives away my age. I work at United Hospital, as I said, and I am first vice president of the Minnesota Nurses Association, and thank you for the opportunity to address you today. Following Jean's example, I'd like to continue and highlight a few other patient safety concerns that we have. Nursing practice and education standards different in each state. National nurse licensure language infers multi-state nurses will know and observe the Nurse Practice Act and rules as well as other relevant state laws, whether that has been recently addressed or not. It is unreasonable to presume nurses would become proficient in those laws and rules of another state, especially if they were practicing there intermittently. National licensure requires party states to unconditionally accept the licensure standard of the other states. This could lead to a lowest common denominator of state license standards. In this case, Minnesota would not have the ability to set licensure standards for nurses licensed in other states, yet these nurses are practicing here. The National Nurse Licensure Structure Mandating Regulation based on site of residence, not practice, undermines the state's regulatory intent. An example of differing standards is delegation, one of the nurses' greatest responsibilities as we care for our patients. Everyday nurses work as a part of a team, which requires delegation of nursing care to other licensed and unlicensed team members. Currently, each state independently determines who may delegate, what care may be delegated, and the supervision and training necessary to perform the delegated care. If Minnesota adopts national nurse licensure, who will determine these parameters? If Minnesota determines a set of expectations regarding delegation, but these are in conflict with the national nurse licensure, Minnesota will not be able to implement and enforce Minnesota standards. As Jean noted, two other states have opinions from their state's attorney, or maybe this is information Shannon will be giving you, sorry. Two other states have opinions from their state's attorney general ruling that adopting national nurse licensure is unconstitutional. In addition, under national nurse licensure, there is no mechanism for identifying nurses who are practicing in the state, where they are employed, and what type of practice they are performing. This limits the state's ability from protecting patients from potential harm. Finally, where does the patient go in the event he or she needs to file a complaint about nursing care? If the nurse who delivered care to the patient was from Arizona, does the patient file the complaint here in Minnesota, or is it in Arizona, or is it with the national board? These are questions that are of concerning to us. As you can see, this creates consumer confusion. Thank you for this opportunity to testify.
Thank you, Ms. Engeldorf. And is it Ms. Cunningham next, and then followed by Carrie Mortrud?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Shannon Cunningham, and I am the Government Relations and Public Policy Specialist for the Minnesota Nurses Association. Article 3 of the Minnesota Constitution states, "The powers of government shall be divided into three distinct departments, legislative, executive, and judicial." Nowhere in our Constitution does it state that the powers can be divided or delegated to an entity outside these branches. The Constitution allows the legislative branch to create the Board of Nursing, but to join a national compact is a stretch and violates our constitutional delegations of power. In Kansas, the Attorney General wrote a brief that stated, "The compact does not allow compact administrators to set aside any minimum licensure standards for a state to be admitted to the compact. Enactment of the compact would essentially delegate to the legislatures of other states authority to set the minimum licensure requirements for licensees in those states who practice in Kansas." Additionally, the Louisiana and Nebraska attorney generals came to the same conclusions. The Louisiana attorney general stated, "Because the compact would, through absolute reciprocity, allow other state legislators the unqualified right to determine the qualifications for the practice of nursing in this state by non-residents, we believe the compact would be an unconstitutional delegation of legislative authority." In Pennsylvania, it was cautioned the National Nurse Licensure Compact violated the constitutional due process grounds. Under the compact, Pennsylvania nurses could be subject to multiple investigations and disciplinary procedures and be held responsible for subsidizing the costs of these investigations. Additionally, they asserted that compact nurses would not be able to protect their reputations because they would not be informed about what information had been submitted about them to the coordinated licensure information system. Although we recognize that the Minnesota Constitution is not the same as other states, we believe that joining the National Nurse Licensure Compact would be a violation of the Minnesota Constitution's delegation of powers and due process clauses. In addition to the constitutional questions, it appears that the National Nurse Licensure Compact is in direct contradiction to Minnesota state law. Minnesota Statute 214.001 states that all state licensing boards, including the Board of Nursing, are charged with formulating policies and standards governing the occupation. If you look at the National Nurse Licensure Compact website, it does clearly state that in order for a state to join the compact, the bill language must mirror NLC model legislation. In that model legislation, they actually go as far to state that every nurse practicing in a party state must comply with the state practice laws of that state in which the patient is located at the time the care is rendered. Makes sense to me. But despite that language, there are at least two states who have passed National Nurse Licensure Compact legislation, and the compact has rejected their bid because the legislation did not actually mirror model compact legislation. In 2004, New Hampshire passed legislation authorizing it to join the compact, with a caveat that nurses licensed in the compact undergo New Hampshire's criminal background check. The compact refused to permit New Hampshire to join because the legislation was not identical to that of other states. In order to join, New Hampshire was actually forced to drop their criminal background check requirement in order to join the compact. Indiana faced a similar issue when they passed legislation to join the compact with the caveat that compact nurses practicing in Indiana would be responsible for a $25 fee to offset the loss of revenue. The compact would not allow Indiana to join, and the Indiana compact law expired without them being admitted. So despite the National Nurse Licensure Compact directly stating that nurses must comply with state law, the compact itself could very well deny your admission if they do not like your state law. This completely and unnecessarily takes the rights away from our state government and gives it to the compact. In another Minnesota statute, 214.10, states that licensing boards shall suspend, revoke, or refuse to renew the license of someone convicted of crimes related to the mistreatment or exploitation of a vulnerable adult. If you look at the National Nurse Licensure Compact, nearly half of the states in the compact do not require any form of criminal background check as part of their nursing licensure process. If these so-called home states aren't checking criminal records, and Minnesota is not allowed to check these individuals' criminal records, as indicated in New Hampshire, who's looking out for the safety of our citizens? These nurses could be working side by side with Minnesota nurses who are held to a different standard. Lastly, it's obvious that the National Nurse Licensure Compact is merely national nurse licensure without national jurisdiction. This is a dangerous road to go down. According to the compact, the party state, in our case Minnesota, would have a right to revoke the privilege of a nurse who is practicing under the compact in their state and could try them for violation of state laws. However, only the party state only has the authority to do something about the nurse practicing in that state. It is up to the home state of that nurse to decide whether any action is taken against the nurse's actual license. This could lead to a scenario where a nurse from Texas who's practicing in Arizona, they violate the Nurse Practice Act, something happens, a patient dies. Although Arizona could ban them from their state, it would be up to Texas to revoke their license. And if Texas doesn't enter into the lengthy and expensive investigation across state lines to determine if the license needs to be revoked, that nurse would be free to practice in any other state. This happens more times than not, and it's a danger to our patients. So in closing, the Minnesota Constitution clearly states that the National Nurse Licensure Compact would not only violate the rights and due process, the right of due process and legislative delegation, but also violate state law by delegating the authority of the Board of Nursing to the National Nurse Licensure Compact and prevent us from authenticating the credibility of nurses practicing in Minnesota. Mr. Chair and members, I ask you why our state should drop our standards to join a compact which may very well put our most vulnerable citizens in harm's way. Please consider the impact that this national licensure will have on our state and the quality of care we provide. Thank you for your consideration.
Thank you, Ms. Cunningham. Are there questions for the witness? The last one I have on the list is Carrie Mortrout. Welcome to the committee.
Good evening, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Carrie Mortrude, and I'm a registered nurse and a lobbyist with the Minnesota Nurses Association. There have been a number of misrepresentations, and the one I must address is that the Minnesota nurses oppose criminal background checks. We do not. To wrap up tonight, I want to bring up one last point. Proponents for national nurse licensure state that telehealth or telemedicine is one of the main reasons to adopt national licensure. If this is true, we really welcome the discussion. Some employers claim they need national nurse licensure to employ advanced practice nurses rather than doctors in their clinics because it's more economical. The problem is, national nurse licensure does not apply to advanced practice nurses. there is no provision for APRNs to work beyond the registered nurse scope. Registered nurses understand and appreciate patient needs and especially the need for continuity of care. There is nothing quite so debilitating as a patient regressing because their relationship with the provider is interrupted. Again, if continuity of care were the true issue, let's talk about telenursing to mirror telemedicine. Because so many questions remain unanswered, we urge you to vote no to national nurse licensure. Joining the compact does not further the purpose of protection of the public. Rather, it promotes the interest and expediency of business, imposes the lowest common denominator in nurses' practice, impedes the ability of states to establish greater or more stringent protections for its citizens, and ignores the fact that a majority of registered nurses oppose the compact. Those of us who oppose it clearly understand that our ability to protect the citizens of our states would be determined by the states in the compact with the weakest public protections. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Mortrude. Are there questions for the witness? Senator Sharon.
I get a little mixed up because I hear conflicting things being presented. One of the things you said is that the Nurses Association is not opposed to criminal background checks. But I heard what I heard was that there's opposition to a bill that's in front of the legislature related to criminal background check. Could you? So I think that's where the confusion comes. It might confuse the committee that the Nurses Association is opposed to criminal background checks. Could you address that a little more clearly?
Ms. Mortrude.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, yes. Minnesota nurses do not oppose criminal background checks, and in fact, most of our employers, all of them do. We can't get a job in the hospital unless we've had a criminal background check, and it's even beyond hospitals. We oppose the Board of Nursing's criminal background bill, but in fact, we have drafted our own and hope to introduce that very soon. That mirrors the dental provider's bill.
Thank you. And may I?
Senator Sharon.
There's some discussion about, and I think there's confusion in terms, we use the same terms about standards. If the nurse has to practice to the standards or the scope of practice regulations within the state that they're practicing, not under their home state rules and regulations. So if you go to another state, you have to practice under their standards. So that's one discussion about standards. But then the other discussion about standards is that somehow being a part of the compact lowers the standards in the home state. Those are two separate things, at least as I'm listening to people. Could you discuss the differences between that and then repeat what your concern is about that?
Sure.
Ms. Mortrude.
Mr. Chair, I'll try, Senator Sharon. Our concern is that as other states have attempted to put in more provisions to specifically address their concerns, they have been rejected by the compact administrators because it does not mirror what they want. And it varies from criminal background checks to whom care can be delegated to, from, and what that training and education in order to provide that care is. And specifically with the delegation, that's where we're concerned, is that there's different standards when it comes to delivering care among all the different states, and you would be expected to know all the delegation parameters in all the states that you're working.
Sir, sure.
So let me just articulate what I think I heard you say. That when you're talking about standards being established by the National Licensure Compact, when states said, we'd be willing to join this compact if you lifted your standards for CEUs or for this or for what, if you'd have more common delegation language that goes to a certain standard, the compact has said no.
Correct.
That's correct. But what the compact says is that rather than us as a compact raising those standards, we're going to say that the nurse, when they practice in the state, has to meet the standards that are established by the Board of Nursing in that state. Is that, am I correct in articulating that? And then the second part of what you've said is, then it lays the obligation on the institution or on the nurse who's doing the delegation to know the variations on the theme depending on who they're working with and what their home state licensure is. Is that correct?
Ms. Mortrud.
Correct. And that actually brings up another question that we've asked and we've gotten inconsistent answers is, who is the responsible party or group to hold people accountable to know the Practice Act that they are practicing in that state? Some have said it's the individual, and others said it's going to be the employer. If it's the employer, we're interested in what the plan is on how that's going to happen.
Thank you. Senator Hoffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. To the testifier, I'm a registered nurse, and I actually am a co-author on this bill, so obviously I support the bill. And in my practice and in my education, one of the things that I was taught over and over again that I am indeed responsible to know, number one, the law of where I practice, but not only that, but also the policies and the procedures of the establishment that I practice in. So are you telling me here that the MNA says that the nurse is not responsible to know the law in the state where they practice? Because that's my understanding when I got my license, and I'm still currently licensed in Minnesota.
Ms. Mortrud.
Mr. Chair and Senator Hoffman, no, we're not saying at all that the nurse isn't responsible. They definitely are responsible to know. If we're in the telehealth situation, you take a phone call from Arizona, Texas, Wisconsin, North Dakota, South Dakota, you're supposed to know every rule, every policy, and the Nurse Practice Act in those areas when you're talking to those patients. And that's what we see as unrealistic.
Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, maybe this isn't the right testifiers for this question, but as I was reading the ProPublica article, the thing that jumped out at me was how long it took for another state to find out that somebody had had an action against them or had had their license surrendered or whatever. So I guess my question is, what kind of an organization runs the compact, and why are they not in the 21st century where there are secure ways to put information from one state to another? You know, if Minnesota takes an action against a nurse, pulls a license or whatever, and is in the compact, why shouldn't every other state know that within about 24 hours? And why aren't those states then required to take appropriate action so that people who are not practicing up to the standards of nurses are still out there being nurses? I guess that's one of the things that really bothers me in this whole thing is, you know, there are ways to get good information back and forth and securely. You know, we don't have to put it out on Twitter, but, you know, a secure part on your website would be really important. And I'm just kind of curious about who this group is that actually runs this, who can't figure out how to tell another state that something's wrong.
Ms. Brecken, did you want to answer that question?
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgin. First of all, I think there's two questions. The first one is who administers the compact, and that is the nurse licensure compact administrators, and it's comprised of the executive directors of all the 24 states that are current executive directors of the boards of nursing from all the 24 states.
So, Mr. Chair and Ms. Brecky, if Minnesota adopts this, that would be you.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, that is correct, and that is in the compact that states that the compact administrator is the executive director of the Board of Nursing. The database that you're referring to is called NurseSIS, and it is administered the database by the National Council of State Boards of Nursing. So again, it's all of the boards of nursing organization that administer this database. The article that you're referring to, the ProPublica article, certainly pointed out what I would say were gaps in the system. Unfortunately, that's true with or without the compact, that nurses do hop from state to state to state to state. What the nurses does is make that information more readily available to individuals or to the individual boards of nursing, as you said, immediately or within 24 hours. Actually, to be a member of the compact, one of the requirements is that all disciplinary action that's taken must be posted to the nurses within 10 days so that that information becomes available to all of the other states. And that right now is how we get our information in Minnesota also, because we contribute our nurse licensure information as well as our disciplinary action information to that database. And we do it within 24 hours of taking that action.
So, Mr. Chair,
Senator Higgins,
and Ms. Brecke, why is it taking 6, 8, 9, 10 months in these situations that were in this article?
Ms. Brecke.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, I'm sorry, because I don't have the article in front of me, so I don't know exactly what it is that you're referring to. It's been many months since I read that article. But again, those were individual situations that did get addressed, and those particular, as the compact administrators identified how did that happen and changed whatever process was necessary to compel that state to get that information into the database. I believe one of the states that one of the previous speakers addressed was California. California, of course, is not a member of the compact. And you may or may not have read some of the articles that were written, again, by ProPublica a couple of years ago, in which there were very lengthy times for California to take action. California is a state that has almost 400,000 nurses. At that time, there were 25 investigators that were being shared by all of the licensing boards, including the Board of Nursing, and not the Board of Medical Practice. The Board of Medical Practice had its own investigators and, in fact, had 100 investigators for the Board of Medical Practice. Subsequent to that, there was, of course, a much greater appropriation to get more investigators for the California Board. And I don't know if that's the one you're referring to, but that was one of the states that I heard referred to.
Mr. Chairman, if I could also, it sounds to me that it's been about a year since I looked at that article as well, Senator Higgins, and I'm sure it's in my big thick file here at some point. Those were exceptions to the rule and not the norm, and that's why those are highlighted in the article. But as Ms. Brecken said, that those were our issues are addressed and dealt with as anomalies and problems taken care of.
All right. We do have an amendment that we need to add to the bill before we move it along. But, Senator Hoffman, do you have a question?
Well, for Ms. Brecken, Mr. Chair. Sure. Ms. Brecken, could you tell me about how long it takes, if I'm a nurse from another state and I've had a disciplinary action, how long, and let's say I come to Minnesota to get a license, how long would it, number one, take me to get a license, and how long would it, number two, would you find out about my disciplinary action?
Ms. Brecken.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, the process you're referring to is licensure by endorsement, so that a nurse who is licensed in another state moves to Minnesota. What we do upon processing that application is to, first of all, access the nurse's database to see if there has been disciplinary action in any other state or if the license is current or whatever states it's current in. Secondly, we access the website of all the states in which the individual is licensed. Thirdly, we access the National Sex Offenders Database to see if that individual is on is in that database. Fourthly, we access the the Social Security Death Index to determine whether or not that individual shows up there. And the final database that we access is called FITS, and it's a fraud identification system that, so for instance, all the boards of nursing contribute to that database individuals who have applied for licensure in person that with a false identity, or impersonated a nurse, or practiced without a nursing license in any given state. So we check all of those databases. We do that electronically, of course, and I'm very proud to say we're able to do that within 24 hours of an individual applying for a license, that we automatically check all of those databases and their current state of licensure and their original state of licensure to determine their licensure status.
Senator Sherry?
On Senator Hoffman's. And once the endorsement license is approved, is it a renewable situation like a regular license, or how long is that license current, I guess it would be?
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon.
Ms. Brecken, go ahead.
The license is the same as somebody who is licensed by examination in this state. The license is issued upon verification of everything that I have I've told you, and that license then will be good until the renewal period, and generally is 24 months. There's some little exceptions for that depending upon, because you know that the license is renewed dependent upon the individual's birth date and birth year, and so sometimes it gets a little shorter and sometimes it gets a little longer to get them on that two-year cycle.
Senator Sharon.
So they follow a renewal process like a regular license, and that includes a requirement under the endorsement model for the continuing education credits in the state of Minnesota?
Mr. Chair?
Ms. Brecken.
Senator Sharon, that's correct.
Okay. All right, thank you. Members, there's been an A3 amendment that has been distributed, and we've been instructed by our fiscal analysts that even though there is a fiscal note that requires some expenditure of money, that the board has the ability to finance out of its own fund, but it requires an appropriation to be made from that fund. And so this amendment, I think I've stated that correctly, and Mr. Albrecht can correct me, but so we need to attach this appropriation to allow the monies to be used from the fund. So if Senator Benson would be willing, I would ask Senator Benson to move the A3 amendment to Senate File 230. Senator Gerlach, any comments, questions? Are you understanding what we're doing here?
On the amendment, I do, Mr. Chair, yes.
Okay. And Ms. Brecken, is that?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, if I may respectfully, I would like to make two corrections to something the previous speakers addressed. They talked about the states of Nebraska and New Hampshire not entering into the compact, and in fact Nebraska and New Hampshire are both states that are one of the 24 states in the compact. The previous speaker also addressed the fact that of the 24 states that are in the compact, over half of them do not require criminal background checks. While I don't have the exact number, I think the number is more like 3. And in fact, for example, the state of Maine, and those states are, like Minnesota, do have a bill in the legislature to get authority to do criminal background checks.
All right. Thank you, Ms. Brecken. To the A3 amendment, any questions from members of the committee? Again, Senator Benson renews her motion to amend Senate File 230 with the A3 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The amendment carries. And now to Senate File 230 as amended. Any further questions from members? Senator Sharon.
Sorry, since you're there, on this license by endorsement, I think that this is called a reciprocity arrangement between states, the license by endorsement. It's the way in which, under current, aside from this nationalized system, this is a way in which nurses in Minnesota can practice in other states. And what I heard you say is that the Board of Nursing does this through endorsement, and you do go through a variety of checks. You're able to do it in 24 hours. But the criteria for allowing the license in Minnesota is that the standards of practice are essentially the same or reflective of the standards in the state of Minnesota. And that is one of the strengths, I think, of the reciprocity process under the endorsement, is that the decision is made by the Board of Nursing, and it's based on choosing states for reciprocity that have similar expectations and standards.
Mr. Chair, Senator Sharon, you are correct. The language in the current law that provides for licensure by endorsement is something to the effect, and I won't be able to quote it exactly, but that the Board of Nursing endorses licenses by endorsement from those states in which the licensure requirements are substantially the same.
Right. Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Brecken. I believe we have the bill in front of us as amended.
Mr. Chair, if I could just make a couple quick closing statements. Members, just very briefly, I know you've heard a lot of testimony, and I'm wanting to jump up all through testimony and jump in and add things, but I'm going to hold off on that, except for 2 points. One is that you heard a lot that this is a national licensure. That phrase is used intentionally by opponents of this bill to create an impression that you, as a state legislator, are giving up. You're giving up your sovereignty. You're giving up your control over what's going on with nursing in the state of Minnesota. That is not true. The state, the Nurse Licensure Compact is a state-based license, and it's just recognized by other states. That's a fundamental point that I really want members to understand. And then very lastly, we had a lot of talk about, what are people's interests in this? And while we were testimony was going on, I looked up the mission of the Board of Nursing. This is your board, even though I was doing this. And I looked at it, and it says, the mission of the Minnesota Board of Nursing is to protect the public's health and safety. And then it goes on how it does that. It's the reason the board exists. We've heard testimony to the contrary, but the board has done their due diligence and studied this issue and has come to the conclusion that this bill is in the best interest to protect the public's health and safety. That's my final comment. I'm sticking with it.
All right. Thank you, Senator Gerlach. Senator Fischbach, are you interested in moving the bill?
Absolutely, Mr. Chair. I will move the bill as amended.
Senator Fischbach moves that Senate File 230 as amended be passed and, I believe, referred to the Finance Committee, since we put this appropriation and the fiscal note is attached to that. Any final comments on the motion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
The ayes have it. The motion is carried. Thank you, Senator Gerlach. Thank you, testifiers. We have one final bill, members. I hope it won't take too long to deal with it. It is my bill, Senate File 1809. I believe Senator Rosen is going to serve as the chair. Okay. She stepped out of the room briefly. So we'll...
Senator Hand, welcome to the other side of the committee table.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, Senate File 1809 is very brief. It is a repealer, or at least at this point is a repealer of some rider language, part of some rider language that was included in the bill that we passed and was signed last year, the budget bill. And this was language that came about during the course of the discussion that we had with respect to the SHIP funds. And we had passed a bill that had recommended that the SHIP funds not be provided at all. That was amended in the course of the discussion we had with the governor at the during the special session or before the special session as we were completing the work on the bill. One of the things that we asked for or agreed to in the course of that discussion was to provide some language that would ask the Department of Health to provide the legislature some additional information about the effectiveness of the SHIP monies. And that language was later added as a rider to the bill. But there, I believe, was some confusion about what the intention was, and the language that was produced perhaps didn't reflect the understanding that people had around the table. At any rate, since that has happened, we've heard from hospitals in particular, but also plans about the language, and asked for us to reconsider that, which the bill that you have before you is a reconsideration of that bill, and in fact striking paragraph B, which is on page 3, and carrying over to page 4 of the bill in front of you. Do have some people who would like to testify, and I also have in discussion with Senator Laurie. Understand that we have an amendment that we'd like to offer, but before we take the amendment, Madam Chair, perhaps we can have some testimony on the bill.
Wonderful. Thank you. Senator Hand, we have Makita Norris. Okay. We have Kevin Burns, Regional Director of Public Affairs at Mayo. Welcome, Mr. Burns.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members. I'm Kevin Burns. I'm the Regional Director of Public Affairs for Mayo Clinic Health System in the southwestern Minnesota part of our organization. Thanks for this opportunity to speak to you this evening in strong support of Senate File 1809. Mayo Clinic Health System takes our commitment to improving the health and well-being of our communities very seriously. This involves both preventive strategies, getting on the front end of the healthcare spectrum, partnering with local public health and other community partners, as well as our mission to provide health care services to those who cannot afford the cost of their care. Hospitals around the state, each and every hospital around the state, is involved in many community benefit activities that contribute to the very fabric of those local communities. Determination of those community benefit activities is one of the key functions of a hospital's board of directors. For example, in the region that I work, all six of our hospitals have community board members as well as community health care providers as members of our boards. Community benefits, by their very nature, are local activities. They are developed, reviewed, approved, and implemented locally. They are most efficient, effective, and most relevant if done so locally. Let me give you a couple of examples of what we're doing in our region. We've established a regional referral program whereby sedentary patients and others who may be at risk for obesity were enrolled in a 12-week program, and that program involved weekly meetings with providers, fitness coaches, dietitians, and other experts. We've developed a local health resources guide available both in print and online that lists all the medical, governmental, and community-based resources for individuals dealing with or at risk for obesity. We continue to work regularly and closely with local public health, area school districts, and others regarding strategies about the annual influenza immunizations in our schools and for the general population. This collaborative local effort includes the use of resources as well as the sharing of staff and expertise. We currently collaborate on the determination of our annual vulnerable hazardous vulnerability analysis. Now, this is a document that we use in healthcare to determine how prepared we are for both natural and human-caused disasters. So we determine this for our local medical center, our local hospitals, but we do that in collaboration with public health, emergency management, law enforcement, fire and life safety, school districts, and other local entities. At the Mankato Hospital, I'll give you an example so we can quantify some of this. In 2006, the total cost of uncompensated care just at the Mankato Hospital was $31.5 million. 4 years later, that figure had more than doubled to $66.5 million. And last year, the total cost of uncompensated care just at the Mankato Hospital grew to $71.1 million. That demand is growing, members. In addition, the Mankato Hospital, every year on an annual basis, we subsidize our local mental health services to the tune of more than $1 million. This is a loss leader for our hospital in Mankato. We provide that service, we make that investment, because that is what is needed in the local community. One of the provisions in the Accountable Care Act is a new requirement for hospitals to conduct a community health needs assessment at least every three years. We've already begun work on this important effort in collaboration with local public health and input from other groups in and around our local hospitals. I can tell you that based on the current demand for community-based mental health services, there's little question in my mind that there will be identified a continuing need for that local mental health services when we do our community health needs assessment, and that those local services will require subsidies. I'd like to also point out that our hospital has been a very strong supporter of the SHIP grants, and we use that support in a true partnership with local public health. This does not mean, however, that we support a regulatory approach from the Department of Health overseeing hospital community benefit activity. Public policymakers should identify where the SHIP program has been effective, and we are hopeful that funding can be restored in the 2013 session. Madam Chair and members, we hope that you and other lawmakers will join us in recognizing that hospitals with their own community boards and local partners have done a good job in determining and providing community benefits based on the needs of their own unique communities. We ask that you join in supporting this to keep this process locally determined. And that's at the heart of this bill, and we urge your support. Madam Chair, members, I'd stand for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. Any questions from the members? Mr. Burns, you said you'd like to keep it at the local level. And is there an advisory group at the hospital that determines these benefits going forward, these community benefits?
Madam Chair, members, we use our board of directors, which are made up of community members as well as others in our organization. For example, in Waseca, one of our community board members is the executive director of the Waseca County Public Health Department. In Fairmont, the chief of police sits on our board of directors. In New Prague, a local dentist sits on our board of directors. In Mankato, the chief financial officer for Taylor Corp sits on our board of directors. That's the key to keeping this local, is we are already using locally based people outside of our organization, the real folks, house husbands, small business owners, school district superintendents, all populate various of our local boards, and that's how we keep community benefits relevant and local. The folks in Fairmont know how best to spend those resources in partnership in and around the Fairmont area. Similarly, in other communities throughout the state of Minnesota, this is by definition a local activity, and our goal here is to keep that focus locally.
Thank you, Mr. Burns. And do they have a chance to talk to the other communities that within the Mayo infrastructure?
Absolutely. Not only do we have local community representation on our local boards, but we have those same community representatives at our regional board, which oversees all six medical centers and some 23 clinic locations throughout South Central and Southwestern Minnesota. So that, but because we are one organization, that inherent nature of communication already exists. It's hardwired into our organization. So the short answer, Madam Chair, is yes, definitely.
Thank you. Any further questions? Senator Sharon.
I don't know exactly how to ask this, Mr. Burns, but piggybacking off Senator Rosen's question, and there are other systems. Mayo Health System is what you're talking about here, but you're talking about local dollar, your dollars that are spent in the local community for such activities as you've described, or money that you give to Open Door Healthcare Center that's acknowledged as a priority within that community. It's unique to that community and not Fairmont. And it's not unique to Faribault. It's not Waseca's. But each local community defines the unique nature and needs of that community. So even though you have a regional health systems board, does that regional board draw money away from the local use in Mankato or a Waseca for a regional purpose?
Madam Chairman, Senator Sharon, no. That local control is with the local board of directors. So there is a local board in Mankato that is oversees just the Mankato-based hospital operation. There's a local board in New Prague that does the same thing, a local board in Fairmont. Now, there are a number of members from those communities that serve on the regional board, but the local decisions are made by local people on local boards. And that's the beauty and the relevance of how we implement our community benefits. And we want that to remain in place, because those relationships, not only the dollars, but also the relationships with local public health, with community leaders, with underprivileged or underrepresented groups, are by definition local. And that's the way it is now, and we don't want to lose that.
And just a follow-up question. So you're consistent in your system as to what you're asking us to do at the state level. You don't direct local government, local boards, how to spend their local resources, and you don't establish a requirement that the proposals be reviewed at a regional level. It's kept at a local level.
Mr. Burns. Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, that is correct. There is no hierarchy of commitment, control, or oversight. The review, approval, and implementation all directed on the local level, and that's where it stays.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Burns.
Madam Chair, members, thank you.
Senator Hand, we have Ms. Pennington. System Director of Development at Health East Foundation. Welcome, Ms. Pennington.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, thank you so much for having me here this evening. My name is Joan Pennington. I'm the System Director of Development for Health East Foundation, and I'm responsible for our community benefit and our community health needs assessment. As a community-based healthcare delivery system, Health East has a long history of serving the community health needs beyond our primary function of providing hospital and physician services. Health East was established in 1986. We are St. Joseph's, St. John's Hospital, Woodwinds Hospital, and Bethesda Hospital. And we were brought together with a rich community outreach from each of these organizations and brought them into the Health East care system. Even during our most challenging financial times in the early years of Health East's existence, the organization's commitment to community health service was above and beyond the core services in partnership with our community organizations, and that has not faltered. Health East has made a practice of conducting an annual inventory of those activities and reporting those on our IRS 990s. That information is shared with the broader community in our annual report to the community, with our board of directors, through our quality of care committee, and with our broader organization through employee forums. And in fact, in our fiscal year 2011, our community benefit activities totaled greater than $14 million. Historically, the driver for the development of these programs has grown out of individual staff and physician recognition of the need and the opportunity in our community. We do this in three ways. First, by directly providing programs or services right in the community and with the community, by partnering with local advocacy groups, and by partnering with local community health and human services organizations. Here's just a few examples. Our Health East Faith Community Nurse Network, we provide nursing services in partnership with 12 local churches, providing
services to more than 24,000 members of those churches. Another program is our Passport program. This is a program serving more than 32,000 people in the East Metro. Again, it's a free program, and it serves people ages 50 and better. Partnerships with local advocacy groups like the American Cancer Society, the American Heart Association, and Minnesota Brain Injury Association are important for the health of our community. One such example of our partnership there is working with the American Cancer Society in developing cancer support groups. And some of our community connections are tied very specifically to developing our future workforce. We participate in the University of Minnesota Family Medicine and Community Health Residency programs at two of our hospitals, St. John's Hospital and St. Joe's Hospital. And we have partnerships for nursing and other clinical and leadership education and development programs with other post-secondary schools. As you know, the federal government now requires that hospitals conduct a community health needs assessment. And we have been working on that assessment planning since April of 2011. We have been utilizing internal research staff to conduct our secondary data collection and reviewing existing public health needs assessments. And additionally, we've been holding meetings with public health representatives from Ramsey, Washington, and Dakota counties, as well as Minnesota Department of Health. We'll be launching our primary research in April with Wilder Research. Our target completion for this first round of needs assessment and implementation planning is August 31st of 2012, which is the end of our fiscal year. From the outset of this planning, our approach has been one of inclusion of community resources in the process with a goal of creating a plan that works in collaboration with existing agencies and organizations to address the community needs. In June of 2011, a group of East Metro hospitals, as well as Ramsey, Dakota, and Washington County Public Health came together to form the East Metro Roundtable to look at how we could address and collaborate on the federal legislation to conduct community health needs assessments. Our process was well underway when the legislature passed the new state requirements last session. We met with the Commissioner of Health and his staff early on to better understand what their plans were for execution on this legislation. They expressed a desire to partner with hospitals and health plans, as well as community health and human services organizations, in furthering their work. Unfortunately, the legislation creates confusion over the desired approach and result. It calls for state approval of plans. As our experience demonstrates, hospital community benefit activities are inherently local, and you just heard that. Our community benefit activities are ultimately decided at Health East by our board of directors in collaboration with our local community. We are already collaborating with local public health and nonprofit organizations to identify and address local community needs, and we already report community benefit activities to both federal and state governments and to the broader community. A collaborative approach to addressing smoking, obesity, the needs of our aging and chronically ill adults, those with health disparities, and a whole host of factors affecting our community's health is desirable. In fact, it is likely a contributing factor to the high quality of life and health Minnesotans already experience. Unnecessary government oversight and regulation will not advance this work and could divert resources to regulatory compliance rather than addressing community needs. We at Health East support Senate File 1809. Thank you for giving me this opportunity to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Pennington. Mm-hmm. Any questions? Senator Sharon.
Yes, I could ask you this question, or Mr. Burns. I've been thinking about, as I'm listening to the testimony about the wonderful work that you're doing and the processes that you're using to be collaborative and to come in compliance with the planning process under the Affordable Care Act. But would you, either of you or both of you, articulate clearly why you want this rider language removed? What is it in the language that is, if you could succinctly articulate what it is that needs, that is the problem here? You've described beautifully that you're doing good stuff at the local level and that you're collaborative and you engage public health. So what is the problem specifically that you want remedied in this legislation?
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, the current bill takes away the ability to review and approve community benefits from those in those local communities and places that authority with the State Department of Health, by definition going against the inherent nature of what community benefits are and should remain.
And so, it is your understanding that without the removal of this rider, that the department would have the authority to not allow you to spend your money at the local level in the way you want to?
Mr. Burns.
Madam Chair, Senator Sharon, that is our interpretation. The language specifically calls for the Department of Health to, quote, review and approve community benefits activities.
I just wanted that clearly stated on the record. Thank you.
Senator Lori.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess kind of following up on that same question, I mean, this is rider language. It didn't go into the statute books. I mean, it actually does disappear on its own accord at the end of the biennium. I mean, I've been engaged in countless discussions about this, and it's been a little frustrating. I mean, I've never seen such attention paid to, again, rider language that just plain goes away. It repeals itself. I mean, and here we are, you know, arguing about it. And so I'm, you know, maybe you could address that a little bit. What is it about it? And I get the review and approve, and it was, but also I'll say that we've seen the report that this called for, and it didn't appear to me to be an overly heavy-handed where they were going to fully exercise the, you know, approval. It was more of a dialogue, and truthfully, I mean, the state actually did have some good lessons about evidence and how it can be used to move funding upstream to help, and maybe that dialogue could actually be productive. And it hasn't, you know, it hasn't been productive to date. I can sense that from the number of conversations that I've been in, but it does go away, and so I do have to kind of ask, you know, why it's so bad when it does go away all by itself, and if the department did want to pursue a further dialogue along this lines, they'd have to come back to the legislature and have a broader discussion than what happened last session under the cone of silence. And I wasn't there. This isn't mine to defend. I voted against this bill. I mean, the whole thing. And truthfully, the more I learn about it, the more happy I am that I voted against the whole package. But nonetheless, my question remains about the nature of this rider language and its problems. So maybe you could spend just a minute.
Madam Chair, Senator Lori, the rider language calls for the plan to be implemented by July of 2012, thus creating another layer of what we feel is unnecessary bureaucracy. Understand that under the current situation, all hospitals in the state are legislatively required to report their community benefits on an annual basis. In addition, not-for-profit hospitals are also required as part of their IRS 990 form to make similar reportings. So this, in our mind, not only takes away that local review and oversight and implementation, it also creates unnecessary bureaucracy and further, perhaps, expensive requirements that hospitals throughout the state are already meeting through these other avenues.
Senator Lori?
Madam Chair, I wonder, you know, I did catch that, and it was a little bit, it does say on lines, well, in this bill, 326 to 328, the last sentence, the plan described in this paragraph shall be implemented by July 1, 2012, and having an implementation in a rider confused me a little bit, too, as I was reading it. I wonder if we just struck that implementation language and let the rest of it just die on the vine the way rider language does. Maybe I just like your take on that. I mean, and if, and maybe, you know, before we move too far on this, maybe we should hear from the Department of Health and just get a better understanding of, you know, of their perspective of how this developed. Again, I wasn't there. You know, everybody was locked out of that room. I was over in 125 SOB, wishing I could gain access. That's a whole nother story. So this isn't mine to approve, but maybe if we just got rid of the implementation and the rest does just absolutely die on the vine, and if the department wants to come back and propose another method of furthering this dialogue, that would be for another day, and maybe that would be. But I'd like to hear some from the department, if we could.
Somebody here from MDH that would like to testify.
Good evening, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Jim Koppel. I'm the Deputy Commissioner for the Department of Health. I'd like to, if I could, just provide a context. I was in the room when we adopted this rider, so I don't.
True confession.
I don't have any excuse. However, I do want to say this rider and this effort all focus, and I would hope you'd keep this in mind as an outcome we all desire, is some way to attempt to address prevention in Minnesota and to move upstream and to try to save healthcare dollars by attacking many of these causes of that drive our healthcare costs at the root cause, which is through prevention. We just historically, you know, tried to do this right around the turn of the century here when we had a tobacco endowment. And that was around for a couple years, and it went away with the first big deficit we had to face. In 2008, we did health reform, and we suggested in order to ever control health care costs then, and in that legislation created SHIP because there was a focus of reform, and it was identified as a way to save money in the health care. It's the only way we ultimately are going to not go broke in our health care system. And that got cut last year by two-thirds. So we're now to our third attempt in recent years. And what I would like to say is absolutely this legislative language, the rider language as it was written at the time it was written, I don't want to blame sleep deprivation or other things, but there were a lot of things. We put it together, and it was in a rider. It was in the area where we were doing cuts to SHIP. It had things in there that weren't thought all the way through, as riders sometimes happen. And I would also want to add to that an apology because I don't think we got out of the chute very well following the shutdown. And so we didn't communicate well. And there was a lot of anxiety, both in the health plans and hospital community, about what this meant. So having said that, we moved forward. We developed a plan, which we brought to the legislature mid-February. And in that plan, we this was our suggestion for moving forward. We took out the language. Well, we can't take out the language, but we didn't follow the language of the rider, so we don't have approval in the plan. I mean, we'd have no problem with approval being taken out of the rider. There is no need for approval. What we wanted to do was review the plans and give feedback to local hospitals on their plans. No approval, and, you know, our feedback can be ignored. But we believe that there is strength in local collaboration. And I want to emphasize local. The gentleman from the Mayo Clinic said it very, very well, as did Health East. They have great models. We see them as models. Those are not to be messed with, not to be burdened. And it is our interest to truly try to find ways at local levels, because we have so little money in prevention, to try to maximize the outcome. And you can maximize the outcome best when you have local collaboration between health plans, between hospitals, and public health, and other local groups. So we also said in our report that it didn't need to just be obesity and tobacco, because that's very narrow. And there's so many things that can be at local levels that hospitals would want to do. And so we broadened that out and said it just needs to be an area of prevention. Just report to us what you're doing in prevention and who you're collaborating with. It's not our interest to make this onerous. And, in fact, I'm all for taking out anything that is onerous. But I do think the conversation is really important. And I think it has stimulated a lot of local conversation. And I think I would like it to move forward in some fashion. It's what's left of a lot of prevention work that had gone on that got cut last year. And if we take this out, we're basically saying all of that just goes away, along with any additional efforts we might have which don't involve money, but just collaboration. The efficiencies here is just the collaboration that can happen at the local level. And we want to promote it. We want to put out best practices. But we do not want this to be a burden. And if there are changes that can be made to it to make it less burdensome through amendments, we're all for it. But we don't want it to go away. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Koppel. Ms. Creakey, did you have something to say? You keep jumping up and down.
Yeah, well. I can decide.
Mr. Chairman, Madam Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Mary Krinke, and I'm with the Minnesota Hospital Association. And in my 10 years with the Hospital Association, I can honestly tell you that our members across the state are very unified in their concern about this language. As the two previous speakers eloquently said, they really do view this as part of their mission and values of what is the most important thing that the hospitals do out in their communities. And so we really see this language, as well as the follow-up report, as being intrusive into that process. And I appreciate the comments that Assistant Commissioner, Deputy Commissioner Koppel has made tonight, but the report itself still talks about alignment of community benefit and a role for the Department of Health. And our members feel that they're doing a great job in their local communities. And we would like to have a restart discussion on SHIP and really feel that that's best without this language in place on the books. So thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Deputy Commissioner Koppel or Ms. Krinke? Okay, great. Thank you very much, you two. Senator Hahn.
Madam Chair, thank you. I know in conversation that I had with Senator Lurie about this, and he has raised some questions, and he did have an idea for an amendment that we talked about briefly, and I don't know if he's interested in offering that amendment.
Senator
Lurie.
It's an A1 amendment. Let's pass it out and just have it for conversation. I mean, I also offered the idea of getting rid of the implementation and then the whole thing does just plain go away. You know, I don't know. We could also, you know, eliminate obesity and tobacco and approve, but I don't know. It doesn't sound like that flew very well. There's another proposal. It's the A1, and really, you know, I've been engaged in this conversation, like I said, many times, and, you know, absent from the table has been great opposition from the plans. And so I thought maybe what we could do is remove the hospitals from this rider language and leave the plans in. You know, I just kind of thought of this in between meetings, and the plans, you know, heard of it too, and I'm glad I tried to reach out, and they've been looking at it. It's not an attempt to, you know, try to say anyone's better than the other, but I think maybe they could live with. Everybody's seen the report, and it's not a terribly heavy-handed report. It's about collaboration, still trying to insert some of the evidence that we learned about moving investments upstream in terms of prevention dollars, and I think that if we have the A1 amendment with an additional oral amendment that I would have offer. I think Senator Hahn worked a little bit with the plans on this. Beginning on lines 314, strike the words "the implementation." Strike lines 315 through 322. And strike line 323 through 62Q.075. If we did that, it takes the advisory board out of it, and it takes hospitals out of it, and there's still a venue to continue these conversations just with the plans. And I would myself encourage the hospitals to continue working with the Department of Health and try to find a way to make this conversation happen in a better way. And I think it's unfortunate that it's developed in the way that it has, but I would offer the A1 amendment with that oral amendment to it, and just for the committee's review. I mean, I'm not going to fall on a sword over it either. I mean, like I say, I already voted against this thing, so I don't
know. Okay, Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Lurie. I have not had any conversation with the plans about this, and I thought that it might be good to hear from them if they are what they think about the amendment and maybe about the bill itself. But if there's, I think there's somebody from the plans that are here, if they'd be willing to comment on that before we decided what to do with the A1 amendment, that would be helpful.
Right. And so anybody would like to testify on that? Is everybody clear about the oral amendment that Senator Lurie is offering?
No. I can repeat it if needed.
Are you serious? Okay. All right. So it would be on line page 3, line 14. Starts with the implementation and goes all the way down to line 23. Stops at that last sentence, section 62Q.075. That would be Senator Lurie's oral amendment to strike that.
So, Madam Chair, just so that I'm clear, that the amendment would leave the health maintenance organization plans in the rider language, and then the language that has to do with the advisory board and what it does would be stricken. So it would essentially call for a plan developed by the commissioner affecting or with respect to the HMOs, and would require the commissioner to consult with in creating and implementing the plan. I think that's, but there would be no advisory board and the other language associated with that.
That's right. Thank you, Senator Hahn. Is there anybody that would like to testify on this oral amendment to the A1 amendment? Anyone from the plans? Senator Hahn. Yes, Senator Sharon.
Before we vote on it, when we're through the whole process, does this go directly to the floor or is this going someplace else?
Senator Hahn, I'm not quite sure.
This was going to go to the floor. I don't think it has to go anywhere else.
Senator Chen.
I'm just thinking, and Senator Lurie, this is just a conversation. The plans are not here or did not know. Are they informed about this? Do they have a chance to have input? Because I wouldn't want to repeat what we did this summer and do something without them in the room and at least advising us. If this is going directly to the floor, I would want to make sure they had a chance to...
And
Senator Lurie. Senator Hahn.
Just to briefly, the plans were aware of the Senate File 1809. I had talked to them about that. They were in support of the original bill. In talking with Senator Lurie, and I believe he's had some conversation with some of the representatives of the plans about the his amendment to leave the plans still in with the other provisions that we talked about. But I have not talked to them about the amendment, so I don't have any direct information on that.
Madam Chair and Senator Hahn, I appreciate that correction. I'm sorry if I mischaracterized the set of conversations. And I did talk with the plans here briefly. Again, this was, you know, an effort to try to preserve at least some of this dialogue. I mean, I do think that the dialogue about evidence-based strategies to move our prevention dollars upstream is a valuable exercise without adding, burdensome administrative regulations and things. So this was just an attempt on my part to see if there wasn't some middle ground. And the plans had never come to me prior to today to express opposition to this, and so I thought maybe this would work. They didn't like it at first. They thought that it wasn't so great, but then we started talking about, did you read the report from the Department of Health? I mean, it wasn't a heavy-handed approval. It was a review and advisory in nature, able to be ignored, and through working with them a little bit, I believe, and I don't want to mischaracterize them, and if they want to stand up, I believe they're not of a mind to oppose letting this go forward to keep this conversation alive a little bit. And I think that the hospital's goals are met. I don't know. It's an attempt.
Okay, Senator Rosen.
Senator Rosen.
Senator Sharon.
I can just affirm also to you, Senator, that in all of this dialogue, I have not heard from any request to change this language that was passed this summer, from excepting for the group that's now being excluded. So I guess I could draw the assumption that they weren't chasing this down quite like the hospital association was. So they're not objecting to it in the same way that the hospital was.
Okay, Senator Hamm.
Madam Chair, I guess I would be a little more comfortable if we had any comment from any member representative of the plans if they're here. But if they're not, then I certainly am comfortable with Senator Laurie's testimony that he's had some conversation with them and that they, here we go. Somebody is here.
Welcome.
He looks thrilled, doesn't he?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Phil Griffin. I represent Preferred One of the plans, and I'm speaking this evening on behalf of the Minnesota Council of Health Plans. With the oral amendment that Senator Laurie has made, we have no objection to the language.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Saved us a
there
few
questions
minutes.
Behind yeah.
Senator Laurie.
Thank you. I really appreciate you guys engaging in this in a very short time frame and working with us to try to find some way to preserve.
Thank you, Senator Laurie. I just would say to the committee, you've spoiled my record. I was hoping not to testify this.
The big hook came out and got you. Deputy Commissioner, would you like to say something, too?
Again, Jim Coppola, Deputy Commissioner. I just wanted to express opposition to this, that we would like to have had the broad conversation in this effort and would rather have addressed the bits and pieces that were felt to be onerous for the hospitals rather than this process, but in this amendment.
Okay. Any questions? Okay. Senator Laurie, are you moving the A1 amendment?
I'd move the A1 amendment as amended.
Okay. Senator Laurie moves the A1 amendment as amended with those changes on line page 3, line 14, down to page 23. Delete that whole section. Senator Hahn, any further comments?
No, Madam Chair.
Okay. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, nay. The motion prevails. I guess that's... Yes,
and Madam Chair, I have no further testifiers or further comments, but I would move that Senate File 1809 as amended be recommended to pass and sent to the floor.
Good. Senator Hahn moves that Senate File 1809 be recommended to pass and sent straight to the floor. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion prevails. Thank you, Senator Hahn.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
We are adjourned till tomorrow at 10:30. And we will be continuing our agenda until the evening.
Thank you, members.
So
what time is it, 10:30?
There.
That's right.